In a world where right versus left, concrete versus tundra, zealot versus dogmatic, one man steps into the gauntlet of rhetoric with the flags of justice, truth, and honor, with a new vision of the last frontier, and with the courage to tell all Alaskans, I'm back. This is The Tom Anderson Show with Optima Public Relations owner Tom Anderson on Fox News Talk, KOAN, fair and balanced for Alaska.
Well, greetings, folks. This is Tom Anderson. Hey, thank you for tuning in on 1020KOAN.com and, of course, live here in Anchorage. Sunny day. And I look at my guest, Brad Keithley. Is the sun not so welcome after the crappy rain we had for a month?
It's pretty welcome, Tom. The sun, the snow, actually, on Saturday, I like, too.
Yeah, no. That's, boy, are you a skier?
No, but it was just, I started queuing up Christmas music on my iPod. It just put me in the mood.
You know what? I listen to Josh, is it Groban or Groban?
Yeah.
I listen to his stuff, and I know that sounds funny, but I listen to it over the summer, because Christmas is just good. Hey, listen, we have Brad Keithley in the studio. Folks, if you have questions or online, you can write in, of course, Facebook, email, text, and then our studio line's 522-1020. Chris will take your call. And you can ask your question or make your comment. Brad Keithley, are you managing partner at Perkins Coie?
No, I'm the co-head of the oil and gas practice group for Perkins Coie. Perkins Coie has about 20 offices throughout the United States and in China. And I'm the co-head for the firm's oil and gas practice.
Okay. I always refer to you as the managing partner. It's good to have it delineated. Oil and gas, very complex. You've been on the center stage, if you will, in for me. I mean, I have an affinity to what you support and endorse in terms of responsible resource development, in terms of fiscal responsibility. So often these are trite, overused statements. I think you're the real deal, and you put your money where your mouth is, and you have a blog, and money is time, and that's your inventory, because as an attorney, I know how expensive it can be in terms of big projects, and you have limited time. But Brad, you have this blog. How popular is it, and do you have a good rotation of people reading it?
It seems to be pretty good. I think on the peak day, we were over 200 hits. I think on an average day, we're somewhere in the 50 hit range. The blog tries to do a couple of things. It has a commentary, but then it also tries to be a one-stop news source for news of interest to Alaska. I have RSS links to various news sources dealing with oil issues down the right-hand side, and people seem to come to it for that also.
Absolutely. And you have expertise in kind of a wide array of areas. Before the show, I asked Brad, I said, hey, what's some areas you'd like to target? Because the guy has so much knowledge in so many areas, it would take certainly longer than a few segments on this show. I want to get into defined benefits. When I was a legislator, we dealt with that. But one area, and I was reading this to Brad, and he knew the statistics better than I was reading them. But, you know, the Arctic, Shell is close to drilling, what, two wells and three or four
right
in advance, and I think they're called the Kulluk and the Noble Discoverer are the two.
Those are the two rigs, right.
And then they're waiting for the whalers to finish their final hunt?
They're waiting to put the Kulluk in place until the whalers finish in the Beaufort Sea. Because of the failure to get the containment vessel up, all they're doing this season is really drilling the mud holes. They're drilling the beginning holes. They're not going to go down into oil-bearing formations.
And then they're gonna target it next year to get up and running completely. Well, I read to Brad, and I want the public to understand this. I don't know if you know the enormity of the oil up there, but Brad corrected me, it's even more, 25 to 27 billion barrels potential in the Arctic waters and offshore. And if you want to get a comparison, 20 billion barrels were, what did they say, projected at Prudhoe Bay, and 15 have been taken out. That's at least what this article says.
Right, and that's recoverable. And what's gone on at Prudhoe over time is that the industry has found ways to increase the recovery rates. When Prudhoe was initially discovered, the expectation was they would be able to recover 40% of the oil in place in the initial Prudhoe field. Over time, they were able to get that up to 50%, and now they've gotten it up to 60%. And that's frankly one of the issues that we can talk about that gets into oil and gas taxation, the incentives to make the investments necessary to increase those recovery rates, because they're all technologically driven. But in Prudhoe, there are additional levels, additional intervals above the original field that aren't connected to the original field that hold as much oil and gas remaining inside the Prudhoe Bay unit as has been produced since day one of Prudhoe. So there's a huge amount of additional potential right in the existing legacy fields.
Wow.
That is going to take technology and investment to access, but is there on state lands that would be full royalty producing and full production tax producing.
Well, it's huge. And where you first came on the map for me, of course, I met you long ago, and I know your background. Obviously, you have become and risen to be an expert. And, in fact, we have a call-in. I was looking online. There was a couple questions I was going to get to, but one, Randy called in with a question related to the legislature. Hi, Randy. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how are you guys doing today?
Good. We're doing well. Brad's doing well.
Randy, nice to meet you.
Yes, same here, Brad. I've been noticing on your Facebook and all the work you've been doing, I appreciate your support for natural resource development. When you went down to Juneau last year, what kind of impact do you think you had down there? I'll listen offline.
Thank you, Randy. That's a good question. Well, because you were really, I mean, you're in terms of an expert. I mean, you're not. I know that you've done things with the Alliance, with Chamber. When I monitor, and that was another. Someone else asked a question about what is your prediction of next year and in forthcoming years. Mm. I mean, what do you think? There's an impact.
Well, I made a couple of trips to Juneau last year. I think last year there were a lot of preconceived notions on both sides of the aisle going into the legislature. The Republican House had passed HB 110 as the governor's oil and gas tax bill. That was over in the Senate, and I don't think anybody wanted to vary from that. The majority caucus in the Senate was pretty well locked in on how they were going to consider that, and I don't think there was a lot of opportunity for discussion and creativity and trying to find middle grounds and resolve things. So I think my impact, frankly, was limited. I think people listened to me through the ears they had and through the filters they had and sort of stayed locked in on that. I have hopes that we will have a broader thinking legislature next year and the year after that, and perhaps we'll be able to make some progress on some ideas that have been talked about but haven't really been fully fleshed out.
Randy asked, that was Randy Brandt, who's been on the show, and he follows you. He's big in resource development, used to do news on several other stations. I recognize the voice. But another question came in about, and I don't know who, I've heard the name, but Robert O'Brenna, that he came down, and he's an attorney, it said, from the North Slope, and was basically trying to poke holes in any attempt to move forward. And that was part of the reason that you were kind of brought into counter. And I don't remember the story, or I won't say the story, the procedure of what happened. Can you explain? Because I...
Sure. Robin Brenna is...
Oh, Robin Brenna. I said Robert.
Is an attorney for, in that case, or in the situation where we were both down in Juneau, Robin was the attorney for the borough, the North Slope borough, the Fairbanks North Star borough, and for the city of Valdez in the property tax litigation against TAPS. And in that situation, the issue was the life of TAPS. There had been, Gail Phillips and others had talked about TAPS having a relatively short life. And Judge Gleason, in a state case, had decided that, had made the decision that TAPS, that the owners, there was substantial evidence that the owners found that TAPS would have a much longer life. And there was a lot of spin put on that. Some senator said, well, that's great news for Alaska. We don't have to worry about oil tax reform because TAPS is going to have a long life now. My point was that's not true, that the production rate in TAPS is going down. That's what drives our revenue.
And hold that thought, because I want you to keep developing that, because a couple people, some of them legislative and others, write in and ask these questions, and I think the public needs to know what happens, because they're not sitting there, I hope, watching gavel to gavel every second in their underwear. You hope they have lives. Hey, we have Brad Keithley. He is in the studio, Perkins Coie. He is the main guy, oil and gas. Going to have more questions and comments for him. Stick with us. This is the Tom Anderson Show.
devils in dust. I got God on my side.
Okay, we are back. This is the Tom Anderson Show. Hey, thanks for tuning in. I know you have a lot of choices out there, lots of talk shows on right about now, and I try to keep this stuff interesting and relevant, and Brad Keithley is about as relevant as it gets, and I'm honored that he came in. He's busy, and he's got a big firm to work with, and he was very thoughtful to come in today to take up his time to talk about this. We were talking about how huge the resource development potential is. And you talked about viscous. We've talked about, not in this conversation, but other times, fracking, whether mm-hmm. it be in North Dakota. There's so many ways, and without confusing people, bottom line is there's so many ways to drill oil, and there's so much vast potential. People don't realize when you hear some of the legislators say, hey, we're almost out. That's just not true, is it?
Well, no, that's not true. What we're running out of is investment. We're not running out of oil. We're not running out of opportunity, theoretical opportunity. We're running out of investment. And the reason we're running out of investment is because the returns from drilling in Alaska anymore, from investing in Alaska, aren't commensurate with what you can find elsewhere in the world.
And you get into that in your blog, right? You talk about fiscal and you talk about the balance, and you're like, hey, it's not a one-stop shop to fix. It's a mindset and a philosophy.
That's exactly right. You've got to focus on getting the investment levels where you attract capital. There are more opportunities in the world, particularly since the fall of the Soviet Union. the opening of Africa, the opening of Latin America. There's a lot more opportunities in the world than there are dollars. And so opportunities are chasing the dollars. They're competing for dollars. And Alaska's got to be a part of that process.
Now, we were talking, I always bring this up when we talk on the break, we were talking about the makeup of the legislature forthcoming, and Brad's watching me go through my notes because I found something and I can't spot it now, but there was an appointment of Bert Stedman in Sitka to the, I guess, the Energy Council, and the legislature goes to that. You know, obviously, I have connections. With our PR firm, we've helped different candidates, obviously, Liesl, ex-wife, mother with Grayson. There's been a lot of different, not so much you as other folks saying, hey, bipartisan coalitions, there may be good people in them. They don't necessarily work. Of course, I defend Liesl as a little more, and we've talked online and stuff. I think that she, whether you coming in, good questions about your involvement there, has been active and been a champion of not only resource development, but especially of recent working in the public with Governor Parnell. Other legislators have not so. There's this balance of flushing out. I think Meyer and Liesl are becoming champions more and more and have been in the past. Others, Menard, Tom Wagner, maybe less so. They lost as a result. Do you see the coalition coming back in the next legislative term?
Yeah, I think it's going to depend on two or three races, whether the coalition comes back. Everybody has their own opinion. I think at 12-8, 12 Republicans, 8 Democrats, the coalition survives. And the reason I think that is I think Chairman Bert Stedman, Chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, and President Gary Stevens, the President of the Senate, are likely to align with the existing coalition if there's an opportunity for that coalition to survive. And then they need one more to make a majority. Click Bishop up in Fairbanks has already said that he would be interested in a coalition. So
you mean 3 and 8 is 11, and bingo, they barely squeeze on. And then what would they do? They would give away pretty much everything to the Democrats? I mean, I know you can't read crystal ball.
Well, once there's a coalition form, once you get to 11-9, the question is whether Kevin and Liesl go back into the coalition. Because
they won't. I hope they're listening. They won't. I know they won't.
Well, it'll be interesting because the rationale last time was there was going to be a coalition, so we needed to be a part of it because that was going to be the leadership, and that's how the coalition, frankly, got built up last time.
Now let me ask a question there in terms of philosophy, because I'm defensive. Particularly, I ran Kevin Meyer's campaign against Jerry Sanders when Kevin won. Kevin was on the assembly, and he beat Jerry Sanders, who was an incumbent. And then, of course, I have connection with Liesl and praise them both. And I think you do too. Is that?
Yeah, I was on the other side of Liesl in this last campaign.
Well, but let's get into the fact that sometimes when a candidate runs and they truly want to represent their constituency, don't you think it's fair, at least last time, for someone to test the waters and see if Wilikowski and Hollis French's promises will come to fruition? Because I think that that's what happened. I think that they said, hey, well, there's going to be fair and open government. And I know you weren't in there. This is just talking friend to friend. You were not a legislator. Sure. So, I mean, you don't have to apologize or defend anyone. But I've been there as a legislator, and I know that promises can be made. And then suddenly, legislation's blocked. Guys like this Robin Brenna come in, and got hot shots like you have to come in to defend. Mm. And I think you did well to that degree as best you could. But I don't necessarily fault Kevin, and I didn't want to necessarily get into this, but since we're talking about it, fault Kevin or Lisa or those initially to try to work with them. I could see now, prospectively, saying, wait a minute, we got nailed, we got blocked, there was impasse left and right, we're done. Go Bob Bell, go Bob Rosas, go whomever. But do you see that, or do you think that there's a more strict constructionist mindset that someone should have as a policymaker?
Well, I think things have become a lot more apparent now than perhaps they were 4 years ago, or 2 years ago. So I can see something. You know, in hindsight, it looks clearer than it did at the time. I think what that particular coalition did was it just kept the status quo in place. It kept ACEs in place. It kept the spending increased substantially. It kept the same sort of approach in place for another 2 years. And I think, in my opinion, both on the fiscal front and on the oil front, we need to have a paradigm shift in how we've been thinking about these issues. And hopefully, even if it is a coalition, hopefully the coalition, whoever's in the majority, will recognize that there needs to be a paradigm shift. I think it's easier if the new governing body in the Senate is a new group, is Kathy Geisel, Mike Dunleavy, and others are part of that group, because I think that would ease the paradigm shift. I think it would make it happen a lot more rapidly and a lot more easily. But if it is the old coalition, I think you know, the same conversation. I intend to have the same conversation with them I would with the new ones, which is we need a paradigm shift in how we're looking at fiscal issues and how we're looking at oil issues, or else I'm going to start writing my book, The Death of Alaska.
Machiki, what do you think of him in Kenai Peninsula? I don't know him that well. He called in a couple times, very nice on the radio.
He certainly has a good background to understand these issues. As the mayor of Soldotna, he certainly has a sense of what's important from the standpoint of the citizens of that part of the state. I was, frankly, a fan of Tom Wagner. I think Wagner understood oil and gas issues, and Mary Jackson, who was his aide.
Yeah, I like Tom, too. He's a friend.
Understood oil and gas issues. But I think Machecki brings a strong background. And certainly if the Senate forms around, you know, people like Geisel and people like Dunleavy and others on the conservative, John Coghill, others on the conservative side, then I think Machecki will be additive to that.
Now, I got to ask one more thing, since you're talking about the new group. Don't you think that folks like Meyer and McGuire have expertise in the area that is above and beyond most legislators? Because that's one thing that I always wondered. I mean, you're obviously at the helm as well in terms of your knowledge, but I look at Elisol or Kevin working at Conoco and how many committees they've been on that deal with this stuff. Would you at least give them that? Because I know you're not anti-McGuire and Meyer. I assume
right,
not.
No,
I mean,
because
your endorsement means a lot. So it's like, geez, when I read that stuff, I was like, oh man, Brad, I like him so much. Why wouldn't he be, especially with landfill? It's like, God, he's kind of a kid, and good for him. He has the right to run, but it's like he doesn't have Liesl's aptitude.
Here's the deal, Tom. Here's the deal.
Brad's like, you brat, Tom. Let's get into the Vikings.
No, but here's the deal on issues. We are spending our state into a situation where Grayson's going to not have the same opportunities that we had. If we continue to spend at the rate the last legislatures have spent, we're going to hit a point at which we've consumed the statutory budget reserve. We've consumed the constitutional budget reserve. The permanent fund's the only thing left, and it's not going to produce anywhere near the income necessary to keep the state running. And so Grayson's generation is going to be confronted with the need for income taxes, property taxes, and sales taxes. We need to get control of spending. Liesl was on the finance committee. I understand she wasn't the chairman, but Liesl was on the finance committee, had a voice in those decisions, and we set a new record last year in terms of spending, both capital budget and operating
now,
budget.
Now, will you stick with one more segment, because I want to ask about spending and talk to you what I went through as a legislator, the kind of the dynamic of capital operating budget and how hard it is.
Sure.
We're going to be back, folks. Fox News National, stick with us, the Tom Anderson Show.
Honesty.
We're back. This is Tom Anderson, 5:35 p.m. If you're online, it's 1020KON.com. And if you're listening live here, it's 95.5 FM and, of course, 1020 AM. And, you know, transmitter's coming. We're going to have a lot better power on 1020. Stay tuned for that update. In the studio, Brad Keithley, so happy to have him here, Perkins Coie. We're talking about the whole gamut. We were talking about politics before the hard break. Now we're talking about an issue that's near and dear to his heart and pretty much the substance of what he talks about on his blog and social media messaging. And so the question to you I ask, Brad, is why do you write so much about the budget?
Yeah. Karen Rehfeld, who's the director of the State Office of Management and Budget, at the end of the special session gave what I think is probably the most critical testimony that we've got in this state. And her testimony, the question put to her was, tell us what happens to the budget if we enact the governor's oil reform, if we enact the reductions in oil taxes that the governor wants. Rehfeld's testimony was straight up, we go into an immediate deficit. The deficit is $600 million the first year, under the scenario she was using, $600 million the first year, up to $1 billion by 2018. And frankly, I think she was being a little optimistic. I think those numbers are bigger. I think those deficit numbers are bigger. Now, some argued, Bill Welikowski argued, for example, that means the governor's given away too much money. That's not right. What that really demonstrates is we've spent way too much. We're spending way too much. The budget's risen way too much. Just a couple of numbers, Tom. The budget levels prior to the passage of ACES, roughly $2.5 billion, $3 billion annually prior to 2007, prior to the passage of ACES. That was how much the state was spending. From ACES, from the first 4 years of ACES from 2007 to roughly 2011, average of $4.5 billion a year was the budget, some years higher, some years smaller. Roughly doubled what had been going on before ACES. The last 2 years, the budget for last year was $6.7 billion. This is general fund spending. The budget this year is $7.6 billion. Now, that's 2.5 before ACES, 4.5 in the first 4 years after ACES, 6.7 last year, 7.6 billion this year. We have spent ourselves into not only are we putting at risk Grayson's future and Grayson's kids' future, your grandkids' future.
By the way, Grayson's trying to call to talk to Uncle Brad. Just kidding.
But we're not only putting at risk the future of our kids and our grandkids, but we've now put ourselves in a position where we can't even enact oil tax reform because the spending has gotten so high. That's really why I write about the budget so much. We've got to reform. I mean, the fact that the governor goes out and others go out and talk about we have to have oil tax reform, that's all well and good. We do in order to get investment back in the state. But now we've put ourselves in a position where we have to have fiscal reform. We have to reform the budget before we can even get to oil tax reform.
And so your blog, what I hear you saying and what I've read, the foundation is not Bradford Keithley, oil and gas guy, Bradford Keithley, Perkins Coie, resource development. It's deeper and it's broader, and it's about fiscal responsibility. And one of your issues is that spending, regardless of party, because it's not, your point is it's not isolated to a Democrat or Republican.
Right.
It's isolated to the whole body, almost as a whole, is causing such an enormous burden on future generations that it's going to harm us. Now, a lot of folks, I brought up landfill, a lot of people have in campaigns canned, and you're not a candidate, you're in a different field, giving your time up for the cause. You're not running, you're not asking for anything, which makes me listen more, because you're not like, hey, I need your vote, or hey, I'm with a group that needs your money or a trade association that needs your membership. That said, I've been there as a legislator 4 years, also on the school board, where it's easy to espouse a philosophy of fiscal constraint, of every line item in a budget has a constituency, but we must balance the pros and cons of everything. Then you're there voting, and I have been there, you have not, most have not, and it's hard to say, hey, I'm not going to help fund that park or those books, or hey, you're given this much money yep. for the capital budget, and so I'm one guy that's going to turn it away, kind of like the dividend. I say get rid of the dividend because it's squanderous, we should save it, and all of a sudden you're voted out. I'm just talking about pragmatism, yep. and yep. I'm trying to be transparent yep. to say that I'm human and I wanted to get reelected.
Yep.
It wasn't a sinister reason. It's like, I kind of don't think marijuana is a huge deal, but if you say we'll legalize it, you know, you're done.
Right.
So, and now I'm not in office, so I can be more ballsy, to be blunt. But when you're in office, those are the things that you have to balance. So how do you look at that, and how do you really say, hey, I can feel for these humans that are helping people, that look them in the eye and say, please fund my nonprofit too, since you were given $1 million to work with?
Yeah. Well, excellent question, and here's the answer. Scott Goldsmith at University of Alaska Anchorage's Institute of Social
Great
and Economic
guy.
Research has done some really what I think is just tremendous research in the last couple of years about sustainable budgets. And by a sustainable budget, what he means is a budget that we can spend now and we can spend in the future, virtually in perpetuity in the future, at the same level. And the way he does it is he takes savings from the surplus revenues that we're getting now, invests them like we do in the permanent fund. They produce revenue out in the future. And when oil runs down or oil runs out, those investments will continue to produce the same level of earnings going forward. So Scott's done this research and has done the calculations and shows that the current sustainable level of spending is roughly about $5.6 billion. That is a higher level than all but the last 2 years of spending. When you think about the statistics I went through before,
yep.
that's a higher level of spending, sustainable spending that we could engage in all but the last 2 years. But we have to stick at that level and take the revenues above that and put it into savings to make that level workable. What I think the solution is I think we say we spend at the sustainable level. We don't spend above the sustainable level. And so Karen Rehfeld, or whoever the director of OMB is, calculates annually what the sustainable level of spending is. We put it in statute, how you do that calculation, so it can't be politicized. We use Scott's formula to do the calculation to put in statute. You calculate the sustainable level of spending. That's the level we can do today. We can do in perpetuity. That's what we use as our budget tool. And then we can have battles about what goes in the $5.6 billion. Do we fund AstroTurf at Hanshoe? Do we fund, you know, $1 million for a park here? Do we do something else? But we all agree that it's $5.6 billion, because if we go a penny over $5.6 billion, it's coming out of Grayson's pocket. It's not coming out of our pocket. It's coming out of Grayson's pocket and coming out of our grandchildren's pocket. And I think we can all agree we don't want to do that to our kids.
Absolutely. Now, a Facebook question just popped in, and it's a very good one. Have you shopped this idea around with legislators running or incumbents to basically, they didn't write this, but memorialize in a bill? Because I like it. I mean, if I was a guy running, I would say, oh, let's meet, let's say for the House, I would say, I'll be your bill sponsor if you'll let me in the House for that, and then let's get a Senate, you know, companion bill.
I have shopped that around.
That's great.
There's a responsiveness to it on the House side. There's less of a responsiveness, but an increasing responsiveness to it on the Senate side, and I think it's an idea that's picking up momentum. But here's the trick, Tom. You got to actually do it. I mean, last year they spent $6.7 billion. This year they got $7.6 billion appropriated. You've actually got to bring it back down to the $5.6 billion level. That means you can't have AstroTurf at
Hanshoe. No, the frivolity of the capital budget. And I'm guilty of saying, hey, to nonprofits, to various groups, hey, capital budget's coming. You should really get your requests in. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I mean, if it's there, it's one of those. I hear your point, but there's also, like I say, the human side of it, which is if that's how much there's out and legislators are saying, do you have ideas? I've given them,
yep.
even in the last year.
But we've got to agree there's sustainable level
ceiling.
Is the cap, and
yep.
we'll all. And this is not just legislators. Quite frankly, the governor in this state proposes the budget.
Absolutely.
The governor in this state has a line item veto at the end of the budget, and so it's got to be not only the legislators but also the governor that buys into this concept and enforces the concept.
And, you know, but last break, I know you're going to stay with us here. We're almost done, about 10 more minutes. We want to talk about defined benefit, defined contribution, and Brad was talking a little about that to me on the break, but someone did write in about that to get your opinion. And I'll be honest, I never give names, but it's someone on the labor side, so they probably wanted to get your two cents on how that falls. This is the Tom Anderson Show. If you have questions, call in 522-1020. We'll be right back. Walk the streets for money. We are back. Brad and I are rocking to the good tunes. Thank you, Chris Coleman. Now, Brad Keithley's with us, Perkins Coie. We're talking about everything from oil and gas to budget and fiscal restraint. We're going to talk a little about defined benefit, divine contribution, and where Brad thinks the state should go. But, Brad, just on a personal note, you're an eclectic guy. I see your Facebook. You'd like to travel, and you're into culinary and theater. What's your big fancy, opera or symphony?
Celtic music.
Ooh.
The week after this, on Saturday morning, Saturday afternoon, I fly to Cape Breton for a week.
Wow.
For the Cape Breton International Festival, Celtic music. Festival for a week.
I love it.
And that's what really gets me going. That's what I start the morning with when I turn on.
Neat. And do you have UK roots, or you just like it? You look English.
Generations and generations. Well, thank you.
No, generations, I mean, you do. You look like a general, an English general.
It's the mustache in the belly, I would guess.
No, it's
generations and generations and generations ago. But that music just really appeals to me, and I've gotten to know some people out in Cape Breton, and it's just a fun time for me
to
hear that music.
That's very cool, especially something unique like that, because so many people just follow the lemmings to the certain music, and that's a fun one. Okay, we're talking about defined benefits, defined contributions. Someone wrote in, I'll admit I won't say names, but labor, and they probably disagree with you and I on this. And I don't want people to think, I mean, I'm asking Brad these questions. I think I agree with everything Brad said. So, hey, more power to people with some fiscal constraint and thoughts on it. What are your thoughts on the retirements?
Yeah, the answer to that question, for good or bad, is we can't afford it. If you take the proposition that we ought to go to a sustainable spending model, the $5.6 billion, there's not much room in that budget. The unfunded liability, to recover the unfunded liability, we've got in our pension plans now, it's going to ramp up to $1 billion a year of contributions that the state legislature, that the state's going to have to make to that over the next several years. So when you take a $5.6 billion sustainable spending cap and you take $1 billion out of that to pay down the unfunded liability we've got now, that only leaves 4.6, and that isn't going to be a whole lot when you think about, you know, education and health that we're going to have to be paying for in some capital budget we're going to have to be paying for out of that. So we can't afford to add further to that liability. We've got to keep it under control. And I think, you know, for good or bad, we've accrued under the defined benefit plan that we had more liability than we can ever handle. And adding to it, I think, is just the wrong decision. Now, if somebody within the $5.6 billion sustainable spending cap can say, hey, I can create a situation in which under that I can stay under that cap and I can do defined benefits, I'm not going to argue with that, because to me the overriding principle is to stay inside that sustainable budget level. But I just don't see the ability to do that.
When I look at legislative candidates and what they run on and how they run and kind of the plethora of different ideas, one thing that always holds true, and again, I'm more aligned with you probably almost completely philosophically, I look at labor and I look specifically at public employee unions, and I look at Wisconsin and just the vitriol, and I don't mean all of them. I mean that you and I both know many state employees. Good grief, I'm not saying I'm all. It's just like I watched 60 Minutes last night, and Karzai from Afghanistan said I was really touched by people despise him. Some do, Americans, but he was saying, when I get mad at the America, I mean more so the government and the policymakers, not every person that's American. And I'm not a fan of his, but I like that delineation. Same when I bring this question up, which is, despite all the worker ants out there that give us infrastructure and process, don't you think that there's a caustic, almost I don't know what word to use the word define it, but out there from labor, and especially from the very extreme, often labor, or I should say government employee unions, because aren't they fighting this? Aren't they the ones doing a lot of the ads that we see? Aren't they the ones that say, wait, you know, hey, there's conservatives that want to cut the budget. That could mean cutting benefits to us. That means we must fight them. I mean, it frustrates me, because I feel that the most employees, if they really understood what their union management is arguing, might say, wait a minute, we can't sustain this in the state or the federal government.
Well, we've gotten into a situation, I'm not going to talk about the federal government, because I frankly can't do anything about that, and I'm not going to waste my time on it. But,
sure.
But we've gotten into the situation in the state where I think we've gotten into a we-they attitude. It is, we've got all this pot of money. I want as much as the other guy is getting, and so I'm going to keep fighting as much as the other guy does. And I think the unions, frankly, believe that they need to be as aggressive as they think others are in trying to take that money out. The problem that's gotten us into is you start adding those dollars up from the bottom, and you get to your $6.7 billion budget last year and your $7.6 billion budget this year. Legislators don't want to say no. The governor doesn't want to say no. They keep saying yes. The money keeps adding up and adding up and adding up. And, you know, and so the unions are fighting for their share, and others are fighting for their share. We've got to get to a model where we worry about Grayson. We've got to get to a model where we worry about our kids and grandkids and what's going to happen when the oil runs down in this state. And I think the sustainable budget model is the right model to get us to that thinking. I think we ought to go down that track. And then we can fight about, you know, inside the $5.6 billion, we can fight about where it goes. And maybe the fights will be just as bad as they are now. But at least it will be done in a way that gives Alaska, gives Grayson and others a future that's not dependent on income taxes, sales taxes, and property taxes.
And I like how you don't, not that it was bait, but I'll use that term. I like that you didn't take the bait in maybe getting into, not pejorative, but an analysis on who's right and wrong. Your point is, Tom, I don't care if it's a park or books or a new Salvation Army roof. I don't care if it's union, non-union. I want a ceiling. And then from there, let the policymakers debate, and you and I and everyone listening has the right to message them and give their opinion. I mean, that's the American way. And I like that you're able to sift it down to that. Now, a question just came in. Texter, ask Brad what the legislature should do if they invest all reserves like the permanent fund and then spend on the assumption that the investment will generate 8% return and then the investment only generated 4%.
Mm-hmm.
The state forecasts that PERS will generate that same level, yet only earns 4%,
mm-hmm.
thus growing in deficit, mm-hmm. and the legislature says tough luck and fails to fund to actuarial needs or the growing unfunded liabilities.
Right.
On the growing end.
Right, and that's part of how we got into the situation with the unfunded liabilities in the compensation system now. The $5.6 billion, the sustainable spending level, gets adjusted every year, would get adjusted every year. And it wouldn't vary much, but it would get adjusted based on actual practice, sort of the same way the permanent fund dividend right now gets adjusted based upon experience over the last few years.
Sure.
So we can take the experience of our actual returns. We can factor that into the calculation of the sustainable budget level, and then we can use that to keep a fairly smooth and accurate spending level going forward. It doesn't have to. We wouldn't do it the same way that led us to get into this unfunded liability. We'd do it the same way that the permanent fund has done the permanent fund dividend.
I'm looking at questions. I'm not getting a couple more came in, but because we're almost done, why don't we have a wrap up? Brad Keithley's been my guest. Perkins Coie, he's been active in the legislature. Chris is signaling 2 minutes. Brad, just in wrap up, and I'd love to have you on again in the future talking about more issues that come before the state. What advice would you give and what recommendation would you give to new legislators, whether they're aligned to your philosophy or not, as they run in these campaigns and whomever gets elected?
Right. Well, actually, if this were a perfect world, I'd have them spend a week with Scott Goldsmith to understand how the state's finances truly are playing out. He's done some wonderful work in terms of looking not only at the next 5 years or the next 10 years, but the next 15 years and the next 20 years, and what's going on our financial situation as oil ramps down, inevitably ramps down. And understanding that big picture, looking at it in a 20-year time frame, looking at it from Grayson's standpoint, what's it going to be when I grow up, is crucial to figuring out what programs and what plans we ought to be doing now. So if I had a legislator, I would say either spend the week with Scott or read Scott's stuff or think about, at least do research on what happens in the next 20 years in this state from a financial standpoint. Because the decisions we make today will control whether Grayson has to pay income taxes and sales taxes. If we do it right, he won't have to. If we do it wrong, he will.
Well said. As Celtic music comes before you, courtesy of Chris Coleman, you bet. And that's Brad Keithley. Folks, you can catch him. What's the blog address?
BGKeithley, KEITHLEY.com.
Boy, don't miss that blog. It's very informative, and I think it's going to make you think. My friend, thank you so much for coming in. We'll have you back again. This week, lots of good shows. Check it out on my Facebook page, Ethically Speaking with Tom Anderson, and you have a great evening.